All right, we're in database world again, this time with another technical fellow. Who are you?
Dave Campbell.
Okay.
I've been with Microsoft since 1994.
Okay.
And pretty much in the SQL team the whole time.
So you've always been in the database world?
Actually, no. My dirty secret is I have a degree in robotics.
Uh-huh.
And so I graduated in 1984 with a degree in robotics. I went to work for a division of Lockheed because robotics was going to be the next big thing.
Yes.
And it turned out that the AI guys and the robotics guys were kind of standing, looking at each other like 86, 87, saying, hey, doesn't look like it's going to be the next big thing. And I got into being a user of databases by moving data around and actually feeding fixed automation equipment and such. And went to digital in 1990.
Hmm.
I didn't have the database background, but they hired me anyhow and okay. Started there and came to Microsoft in 94.
Excellent. Now, were you there when Peter was there?
Yeah. Peter and I worked together.
All right.
At Digital. A whole bunch of us. So the funny story there is that Oracle came along and bought the product that we worked on. I think it was like in April of 94 that mm-hmm. that was announced. And there were a whole bunch of us who said, hey, we don't really want to go work for Larry. Let's go work for Bill instead.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of us came out here in 94.
Outstanding. And why did you make that? Why did you want to come work for Bill instead?
That's a good question. We didn't really know it at the time. Mm-hmm. Microsoft was sort of the up-and-comer, and that was sort of exciting.
Mm.
But it was funny. There was some interesting things that happened. So we left Digital, and you know, big machines, raised floor, big humming sort of stuff. I think the big machine we had in 94 was an Alpha 64-bit machine. I think it had 8 CPUs and 13 gigabytes of RAM, which is a lot of RAM back in 94.
Mm-hmm.
I came here, and a database server was a PC stuck on its side with an extra disk drive. And the lab was like a couple offices with the wall smashed down. And I scratched my head, ooh, this might have been a mistake. We say Microsoft was like number 6 in a 3-horse race in the databases in 93 and 4. And there are a bunch of people here working their tails off to prove that Microsoft could build a database product, and just came and joined them.
Outstanding. Okay. So now, since you were a robotics person, certainly mm-hmm. you were well-versed in the world of concurrency and
mm-hmm.
parallelism and
mm-hmm.
the complexities there. Clearly in a
yeah.
database, you want to have
yeah.
concurrency.
Yeah.
So what was your sort of, what was your specialty when you came into this in the group of Peter and all?
Yeah, so I worked in the storage engine,
mm-hmm.
and we, as a lot of people know, we actually had a code base that we inherited from Sybase.
Hmm.
And the feature, that one of the marquee features we needed to add after we shipped SQL Server 6.5 was row-level locking. That's the thing we were getting beaten up in the market for.
Hmm.
And so I took that on as a task for SQL Server 7 and wound up writing the lock manager and sort of all low-level concurrency primitives and such. And so that's the piece I sort of gravitated to. And at that point in my life, basically having a gnarly concurrency problem, good night's sleep, and a strong cup of coffee, that was, you know, about as good as it could get.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So let's talk really briefly about that, because I think we all kind of take that for granted, what goes mm-hmm. on down at that
mm-hmm.
level. I mean, so you're basically a lock master.
Yeah, the lock master.
You're holding locks, releasing locks.
Yeah.
And
yeah. It's, you know, it's a piece of code that has sort of that mystique. I mean, there are aspects of the operating system and this and that. And it's a matter of thinking it through, distilling it down to its essence.
Mm.
The biggest challenge, you know, it's pretty straightforward once you get the notion of, you know, atomic sequences and such, to get it and do it correctly.
Mm.
The challenge is to get it to scale and be performant and still keep it correct.
Mm.
Right? And a lot of people optimize just beyond the point of correctness. And one of the things that I find fascinating is that the life of a systems programmer is actually becoming tougher because of the magic that they're doing at the hardware level with respect to you know, non-uniformity in terms of memory, you know, coherence and such, and the challenge we have to do there just to keep that low-level stuff working correctly. And,
absolutely.
You know, speculative execution, the compiler's reordering things in and out of, you know, critical sections and such. And so it's getting harder and harder to do it and keep it correct.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yet the general purpose side of the house, we're making it easier for them
yeah.
by building these sort of abstract libraries
mm-hmm.
that enable concurrency,
yeah.
et cetera.
Yeah, it's fascinating in terms of, I think we will succeed if we can keep have the opportunity to do things in a concurrent way, but have it expressed in a way that's easy for people to understand. And I think the SQL language itself is an interesting way of, in it being declarative with respect to, here's a query that I want to solve. Mm-hmm. And then it's the SQL compiler and optimizer that determines, can I take this query and decompose it into a set of parallel functions underneath? And the degree of parallelism is actually computed at runtime. So SQL Server will go off and look and say, hey, I've got 8 CPUs that I can afford to run this across right now. Let me go compose the query into eight sort of sections and run them concurrently and in parallel. So it's nice. Pretty interesting stuff.
It helps that Transact SQL is essentially a functional programming.
Yeah, and in terms of it being very high level and sort of declarative in the sense that, here's the query I want, the answer.
Go do it however you want.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the level, raising the level of abstraction there, but yet having people be able to reason about it. And it's a fascinating thing because you think about people who move towards databases, they have a challenge in that they've had sort of this imperative, iterative programming, most of them, and to get them to not write cursors to solve queries and do their own nested loop joins, but actually express it in a way that the optimizer can get its hands around is one of the challenges we face in moving them from the world they know into this other world. And I think we'll face the same thing in other programming domains as well.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about, I just interviewed Ted, mm-hmm. And he's announced the launch.
Yep.
I mean, you guys haven't shipped yet, but you're part of the launch.
Yep.
Visual Studio and Windows Server and SQL mm-hmm. Server. What are some of the things that you've worked on in SQL Server 2008? Like, have there been changes to the, the locking mechanism at the lowest levels? Yeah. I mean, what's going on? How's it evolved in that area?
Okay, so that's going to be one of those I'll come back and close the loop sort of questions.
Yeah.
Because for the last 2 years, up until a couple months ago, you see, I haven't even unpacked there yet, I was running a team within SQL Server we called Strategy, Infrastructure, and Architecture. Mm. And so I was... this came about after we shipped SQL Server 2005. As I said, we were number six in a three-horse race, and so it was easy. Our strategy was simple. We kind of chased those taillights. But by the time we shipped SQL Server 2005, we had an opportunity to do something with SQL Server that was uniquely SQL Server and mm-hmm. Not chasing the other guy's taillights. And so I was leading a group where we looked at some of the forward-looking things, made some changes to the development process. So it was a lot of work with customers and a lot of work sort of from afar. And I'm an engineer at heart, so I wanted to get my hands back into the dirt. Mm. So I was asking Ted for the last 6 to 9 months, hey, I need something that I can get my hands dirty in. And so the cloud and data services space came up, and I was pretty excited about the opportunity, having spoken to a number of customers, that I don't think this is a flash in the pan sort of thing. I think it is a fundamental paradigm shift, so... I wanted to be part of it. So no, I haven't touched the lock manager, but I have been looking at more code of late.
Cool. So that's an incredible segue.
Yeah.
Into this notion of cloud database.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there are about 100 different ways to answer it or start answering it. Mm. And one of the things I think about, read a fair bit like others, and you look at the long tail, weak economics, and the fact that there's infrastructure that's reducing the friction, that's sort of remaking businesses and value chains. And I'll go at it two ways. I mean, I think I said I was in robotics and sort of in the manufacturing space in the 80s. And the phenomenon then was sort of just-in-time inventory. And it really wrung a lot of efficiency out of supply chains. But it took... a quantum leap in terms of logistics, if you will, and information technology, and it took a quantum leap in terms of trust between suppliers and the consumers to actually affect that shift. And I see the exact same phenomena happening now, but instead of being around supply chains, it's around value chains. Hmm. So a lot of the customers I spoke with, people now can go acquire things as services. Think about retail banking or other sorts of, and small regional banks can go purchase a mortgage application. They can go purchase this and that and skin it with their own thing and look 90%, as good as the other guys by just pulling the pieces together. And so I think that there's a, if you will, lowering of the friction level around services. And, another way of thinking about this is that there's a, the dynamics fundamentally will shift and I could use SQL Server as an example. So in the early 90s, enterprise database systems were incredibly complex, hundreds of knobs. It was a market of tens of thousands, maybe small hundreds of thousands of servers in the installed base. And one of the things we wanted to do, we were conscious of when we came, rebuilding SQL Server for 7.0, is that we want to go into enterprise with basically the same sort of capabilities, offer at a lower price point. So maybe it was 3 or 4x, cheaper than the other things. We could sell it through the channel. But we also made fundamental technology changes so that it was, 10 times easier to use, and expanded the base install base by factor 10 as well. So it didn't take as much care and feeding. It didn't take as much. So I think that sort of, 4x drop in terms of cost, 10x expansion in terms of the market opportunity, that same dynamic will play out again in the services space. And just the fact that the connectivity is there, people can get at it. And data is a very, very interesting thing in the sense that there are different perspectives on it and new opportunities to take it and sort of mash it up. But I think that just it's a fundamental new world out there for data and databases as services.
Interesting. Yeah. So can we maybe dig a little bit into the database as a service?
Sure.
How that's different from the database as it exists today? Because certainly it exists in a cloud for the most part.
Yeah.
But so what do you mean? What is servitizing? I think that's a word. Have we created a new word yet?
Sure.
Something like that.
Yeah.
What does it mean to turn it into a service?
Yeah, okay. So one of the things to think about is what it means to go provision a database. So today, people have to get their hands on the server. They have to, one way of looking at it is the virtualization of it. And the picture, sort of thing I've been drawing, I actually have a picture up there on the board that I was using
cool.
in the meeting earlier. So,
I'll go at it this way.
Yeah. Cool.
Let's go through several decades. I'll go bottoms up. In the 80s, we had a world in which applications and the database were very close. They ran on the same machine. Mm. And we'd have a TP monitor around it. And if you go look at, say, the late 80s, so we'll Sybase, I give them credit for building the first, I call, viable client-server database. And it's interesting to think of what they needed to do to make that possible. So if you go back to the 80s, there were many, many, just getting bits from one machine to another was a challenge.
Yeah.
Today, we take TCP and the fact that it's integrated into the system for granted. But if you go back to the late 80s, you had Novell, you had Banyan Vines, you had DECnet, you had IBM with SNA, you had TCP. And if you wanted to run TCP on your mini computer or your PC, you had to go out and buy hardware and software. And there are companies that sold TCP stacks and such. So Sybase went along and they said, we have to go abstract that. And so they built a mechanism for abstracting out so people could run across the database no matter what their network of choice was, and they had to describe, they had to abstract this, and they had to describe, if you will, an application-level protocol to go back and forth, and this they call TDS. And so you could describe a query coming into the database server and then get the results back in a way that was consumable by the client. So if you go think about the dynamics of this, they built an interesting set of server capabilities, and each of these clients had a client library that could go communicate with the server, address the server, consume results, and present them back to an application. So I think if you go think about where we are right now in, say, 2008, one of the things to think about in terms of extension is how do we take that same set of thinking that got us to the client-server world and get us to the service world? And it's kind of interesting in that the low-level networking protocols assume that it's TCP and other sorts of things that at the next level up, are we talking about REST versus WS star? Are we talking about... So the way I think about that is, what are the internet-friendly protocols here? And how do we go think those through? And then, what do I need over at this end to go consume them? And here, in the client-server world, we built client libraries to go off and consume the results and presented a call-level API to people programmed against it. In the new world, a lot of people want to be able to walk up to it with effectively a paper description. And if they want to go build a Perl library or a PHP library and go communicate with it, that's sort of where we need to get to in some of these things. But think about the capabilities we have here in terms of, you know, transactions, the things we have in terms of being able to describe rich queries. That's where it's going to get interesting, and just taking that forward to make it internet-friendly, if you will.
Absolutely.
At scale.
Nice. And so one of the things that was announced when we released this video is something that was codenamed Sitka. And now marketing has come up with another name for it, which is the official name, and that is...
Well, that'll probably change, too. It's SQL Server Data Services, which is sort of an umbrella for... You know, that the other picture I had on the board there sort of speaks to this.
Yeah.
So, actually, let me talk to this for a second.
Sure.
So, when we got here in the 90s, SQL Server was a database server and some client libraries. So, if you go back to SQL Server 4.2, 6.0... and there were some bulk utility libraries, BCP and such, to you know, move data in and out of the server. But over the last 10 or 15 years, we've evolved. We don't call it a database anymore. We call it a data platform. And we have things, and I say that the nouns have become more complex. Back in 1994 and 5, it was, you know, rows and tables. That was it. Now we store XML and SQL Server 2008. We talk about spatial. We've done a great job in terms of unstructured data and expanding that. So the nouns are more complex, and the verbs as well. We talk about data mining, about analysis, about reporting and such. And so that whole thing will play out as we move the business from sort of the enterprise space, running this gamut, the data platform, up into the cloud space as well. So SQL Server Data Services is an umbrella name around that. We'll take that whole platform up there. So we're announcing the first step of that, and that's kind of what I was drawing this picture for someone else. There's an interesting, in this new world, to run this stuff at scale and run it at a very, very low cost point takes a tremendous amount of new learning. And one of the success factors, I think, for us in this team and Microsoft in general, is the degree at which we can unlearn. So for guys in this building who come from 10 to 15 years of enterprise software development experience, if they think about designing something and designing and designing and designing and then getting it right and then testing and testing and testing, and you go stick it in the shrink wrap box and ship it to hundreds of thousands or millions of people, is there a different set of success factors around this new world? We don't talk about the engine availability, it's about the service availability. And there are a whole bunch of factors that, you know, fold into that. And so the picture here I have shows up in the enterprise today using SQL Server. People build applications that run the gamut from mostly unstructured data up to mostly structured data with rich schema and rich query. And then they build some simple structured applications around as well. We're going to take those capabilities and move them up, you know, into sort of this cloud world or the internet-friendly world. And ultimately, we'll try to cover that same gamut as well. We're starting with something that was the code name Sitka that is just a simple structured space. We can do it with a single universal schema. And then over time, what we'll do is we'll move things out in this way and this way to offer the full range of capabilities. But just getting this one slice through the entire, you know, from the service platform all the way up through a service that we can deliver to customers is proving to be both challenging and really interesting.
So what are some of those challenges?
The challenges are that you can't build it and test it the way you could before. The thing is live. It's organic. It has to always be running. And so, you know, I had the opportunity to go talk to other large internet properties, and they don't talk about it in terms of the availability of components. They used to say, hey, is the site up or down? And now it's, you know, the thing is so large, is how do you keep it up? And this lends, you know, sort of another level of complexity to 7 by 24. Sorry about that.
No problem.
I think we can just do that. in that, you know, the thing always has to be running, it always has to be evolving. And one of the challenges we have in the data space, the persistent data space, is that we put the data down there, and if it's going to be around for 10 years, we've got to make sure that this service, as we take it forward, we could still get at the data 10 years later with the same sort of service piece. So it's very, very interesting from the database perspective.
Absolutely. And you could imagine that you're going to... Are you concerned at all about scale?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because you're opening the service up, you don't know who the consumers are.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. Concerns about scale in multiple dimensions, right? And you need a new set of thinking to think about keeping the thing going at extreme scale. And the challenge is to reduce the level of coupling in the architecture such that you have an increased resilience. And you want to think about anything being able to just basically have it go down or shoot it and have the bulk of the service continue to run and mask faults and such like that. And you know, in the database space, what we would try to do in the traditional enterprise database space, make the service as reliable as or server as reliable as you could. But if it did go down for any reason, how do you go back and restart from a clean state and go, run restart recovery and such? Mm. In this world, we need to just keep the thing running continuously. And so the way that we've built database systems from the ground up fundamentally changes. And I talked a couple minutes ago about the challenges for a system software guy becoming harder. It's vexing for the software guys doing databases as well, because the recovery protocols that we've built, you might have heard of write-ahead logging and such, the transaction log that we use, they were built, I describe it sort of axiomatically from the ground up, using guarantees that the disks provided. So the disks would give you atomic sector writes. So you could write one sector on the disk, and a sector was always 512 bytes, and it either wrote or it didn't. Mm. And life was good. And when you had SCSI disks, and you could tell them to write specific writes through, and they wouldn't lie. And over the last 10 years, things have gotten way more complicated there through virtualization at multiple levels. So the underlying disk hardware sectors have grown, but they have sort of this emulation where they'll offer it. But the thing you want to avoid is if you write a sector and you say your transaction's committed there, you don't want to ever write it again in a way that could destroy the previous durable state.
Absolutely.
Okay? And so everything we've built has been basically from the ground up based on those principles and just layering on top of it. Now, if we're running on hardware today that doesn't offer those same level of guarantees, or we want to run on industry standard high volume hardware that's much more cost efficient, we have to think about designing the system in a different way, more from the top down, to give us the same level of guarantee, but not built axiomatically from the ground up in the way that we've done it for decades. Hmm. And so the fascinating challenge is there. And to do that just at extreme scale involves a lot of thinking at the individual node and cell level, and then how to keep the entire architecture decoupled as it scales. And we talk about things in terms of a scale-free architecture, in that we should just be able to scale infinitely and not have the system become more brittle and more coupled as a result of having larger and larger volumes of data.
So that's really interesting. Yeah. So, it sounds to me that you're talking about you have some sort of atomic abstraction layer that's purely software?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're, and it's kind of, you can look at lots of analogies. RAID was done at a very low level in terms of redundancy of the storage. Well, if you think about doing that redundancy at a higher level, you both give up some things and you gain some things. And the database guys have been pretty nimble, if you will, of being able to build at whatever level makes sense to do the things at scale. And so, for example, we don't use the file system cache, and most database products don't. They write directly through to the disk, and then implement their own buffer pool and such for efficiency reasons. And so some of these fundamental assumptions, we're building things up at a higher level to get the same level. So, but it's funny because I talked to some of the younger folks now, and they said, databases, isn't that a solved problem? And I want to grab them by the shirt and go, no, you're nuts. It's more exciting now than it's ever been.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
And so, are we talking about, changing the concept or adding a new, so you have, a relational database and now we have some sort of new type of database, a service database?
Yeah, okay, so that's, I can answer that question by going in a different dimension. Mm-hmm. The relational model has stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. And when I started my career in the databases, I was actually in the data model that predated relational, known as CODASIL. Mm-hmm. And it was a network data model. And then I went over to work on a relational product. And It has certainly stood the test of time. And I remember object databases coming along and people saying they were going to displace relational. And I remember XML and people say just native XML. And but a lot of the workloads and stuff we're doing right now actually do require extensions, if you will, to the relational model. And we're doing some of those within SQL Server 2008. And you'll see some of those go on the service world as well. Mm. And the whole SQL Server data services, the Sitka piece, is fascinating in that right now, as it stands, it's a pretty restricted data model just because that gives us the slice through and through. But it's kind of amazing the things that people can build upon it because we're giving them the ability to have more of a flexible data model that's built on top of it. And the hardware has gotten so efficient and such that whereas we were counting instructions in terms of how many instructions per row we were processing in the past, we can offer up a simpler model and not have to be as efficient, you know, instruction by instruction and go processing the data down below and still do a very, very good job. So it does change the dynamics in terms of how people can walk up and think about the system. So, yeah, we will have a little bit of a morphing or extension of the data model.
So I'm still trying to wrap my head around exactly what this construct is. So in other words, this is a SQL Server or a cloud of SQL servers in the cloud that have some sort of software abstraction layer that I interact with as a service writer.
So, so in terms of what we've built thus far, Microsoft's in a pretty unique position in that a lot of the largest properties on the internet, and certainly a lot of the structured data properties on the internet are at MSN. And by and large, they're powered by SQL Server today. So we've learned a lot in terms of what's required to run at that scale and been pretty successful in doing it. One of the things we knew we needed to do, though, is to drop the cost, both in terms of the hardware that we ran on and in terms of the operational cost to go run it. So some of the things I was talking to you about, you're sort of rethinking some of the fundamentals of the architecture. So you can imagine at the lowest level, we've used the SQL Server technology, hosted it in a fashion that it can be run in a lights-out management fashion. So there's a management infrastructure that can provision from bare metal, basically just throw machines at it. It can go, you know, provision them, lay down the bits, get it up and going. So that's sort of what we're working with right now at the basis, doing redundancy and protection of data in an interesting way. And then on top of that, we've built this mid-tier, which is the data service, the structured data service that we talked about, sort of the Sitka code name that's now SQL Server Data Services.
Very interesting.
Does that help?
It does help.
Okay.
I mean, I realize that we're in the initial phases.
Yeah.
What we can talk about.
I don't want to say everything right now.
Well, we can't.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's why we keep it to Sitka. But the broader problem is incredibly interesting.
Yep.
And it seems like you're saying to be a pattern that isn't just a one could argue that the software plus services thing is a fad.
Mm.
But that's probably not it's a pretty weak argument.
Yeah. Actually, we started hearing in the building software plus services. We're only scratching. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah.
It's really taken hold, and I can see what it means for our business going forward. And so, and I think that's one of unique strengths. So the best example I can use, I get people to nod their heads at, the experience that you get with Exchange, both through Outlook, the rich client, through, I've got it running on my smartphone, I get that experience, and through Outlook Web Access. So I get a 80% experience on my phone, but I'm always up to date there. I've got add-ins and such that I've written myself and bought from others to manage on the rich client here. And also, I can walk up to any kiosk and get at my data there. So it's my data presented through a number of different perspectives. And I think you think that's a good example of the software plus services thing. And in today's world, I see there's a lot of people think about it as sort of the base services. And I think a lot of people getting excited or reasoning about services as I can walk up to something that's interesting with my web browser. And while I think those are both, you know, a lot of people have in their mind right now, I think it's the blending of those worlds such that I get the most appropriate experience based on the context. And I use the Outlook, you know, the web client, I use the rich client, I use the phone, you know, pretty much all the time, mm-hmm. Depending on where I am. But the fact that it's my data in one place with different perspectives is something that I value. So as we build this out as a platform, that's something we want to enable for developers. It took a tremendous amount of effort for the Exchange and the Outlook team to go build that experience. Absolutely. And can we take some of that and actually build it into part of the data platform and the development platform to allow others to do it, you know, hopefully in a weekend instead of, you know, tens or hundreds of person years to go pull it off.
Absolutely. And so a lot of innovation is coming out of SQL these days. I mean, you have the Entity Framework, mm-hmm. you have Eric Meyer and team,
oh, yeah.
who's a Niner favorite, you know, they're doing these crazy things like Volta and other things we can't talk about yet. So, you know, basically, you guys are going to continue to innovate. Where do you see, this isn't product related, I just want to get, as a technical fellow, who's a database guy, where do you see, like, the future of databases going? I mean, are you going to, you talk about the componentized model, I mean, just, this is not product specific, just in your own assessment.
Yeah, so I see an explosion of databases, and for me, it's interesting to say that where do you see databases today? So if you went back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and you talked to a database expert and you said that, okay, now, do you think that all my music will be digitized and I'll have a relational database in terms of behind it, organizing it in 20 years? They'd have looked at you like you were crazy. And if you said that, hey, you know what? I'm going to be walking around with relational database technology on this thing, mm-hmm. you know, doing, they would have looked at you like you were crazy again. Mm-hmm. But I see databases both scaling down, and we've got a big investment in, you know, SQL Server Mobile Edition on these things, and scaling up into sort of internet services. And I think it's, you know, having them play together at multiple levels is where things are really, really interesting. And there's been an explosion of innovation in this division in the last couple of years. And there are different people who have their different thoughts on how that came to be, but when we were putting ourselves on the map, if you will. Mm-hmm. We're a bunch of very good people, but we had a job to do in terms of building an enterprise-class database system. And then, you know, we were off working on WinFS, which a lot of the technology has been embodied in some of the things we're shipping in the products right now. The release vehicle changed, but a lot of the work that we've done on that is still going forward. Some of that will show up in SQL Server 2008, some of it's showing up in other places. But that experience actually helped us grow, and that there are times in an environment where all of the problems and all the solutions can start to look the same, and it's helpful at that point to have something jar you from that. And I think that sort of the learnings from both WinFS and sort of, you know, what we've had to learn in the services space has caused that jarring, and people are just thinking about the world completely differently around databases. And so, yeah, it's a having another way of telling the story is that I've got this slide that I use with customers, and I say that up until like the late 90s, natural forces tended to pull data together in one place. Okay, so you think about the mainframe 40 years ago. We paid armies of people to keep information into digital form, and then we brought it to the mainframe to process it. And then you think about in the 80s, the late 80s, large-scale enterprise applications, HR, ERP, CRM, and we had to bring all the data to those places. And they modeled not only the data, but the business process as well. So a lot of companies had to change their business processes to fit into these large applications. So it's tended to bring data together. And then this, you know, sort of industry of enterprise application integration grew out of that. Because you had a view of an employee in many of these different systems, and how do you keep them all in sync? So data was, you know, being pulled together in one place to be processed. And then you start to think about sort of the internet explosion, XML, B2B services and such like that, you know, out on devices. So after about 2000, natural forces in data tended to pull it apart. And so it's databases have evolved to sort of embrace that. And synchronization, as an example, is a key part of it, because I have a view on this and I want to be able to operate on it while I'm not connected, but yet be able to synchronize and have it become coherent again.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it'll be the synchronization in the cloud, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's another thing that you guys have to do.
Yeah. And the synchronization is a great example. a lot of people have come out and provided value by connecting point-to-point sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And to truly make that be part of the platform, some work that's gone on within this division to factor it such that in SQL Server I can get the whole experience, but I can also factor pieces of it out and implement it on different platforms. But synchronization is a great example of where you need platform technology because obviously the value in the large is determined by how many devices you can synchronize and pull the stuff together from. So, yeah, that's pretty cool stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, you brought up a good point in terms of sort of, it's not quite fractal, but it's similar, it's sort of fractal in the sense that you could just take the smaller picture of the larger kind of full-service SQL and get pretty much what you need on in a different context.
Exactly.
Which, mathematically probably isn't fair to call that a fractal, but nevertheless, it sort of gets the point across.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to be really interested to see what, because this is Channel 9 and we're all about developers. I used to be a developer myself.
Yep.
It's like, what does Sitka mean to a dev?
Okay.
Right.
That's a good question. So I think of things in terms of data services that I can compose. I think we've kind of got stuck in thinking of things in three-tier mode, where I've got the database as the back end, and then I've got, I'll separate, I'll have a mid-tier and I'll have a presentation tier. So we think, everyone's got their head wrapped around that.
Yep.
But if you look at how people are composing and wiring things together, they're not thinking about it at the data service level. So I think there are lots of things today that are either too low level down, in amongst the data, or too high level in, up near the presentation tier. So lots of examples. Imagine, here's the one I'll use. So that if you're familiar with NNTP readers and use that and stuff like that. So I'm an old fart. I like,
You still do that.
Because I get it offline fine. I can go sync everything.
Uh-huh.
I could span everything I was interested in one way. I could sync it. I could take it offline. I could respond offline on the plane, and I could sync it all up again. And so, from a combination of RSS and, APP and various forums that don't do or don't support aggregation, I just can't get the same experience now. And it's prettier, going through. Imagine, though, that we defined a data service that was a forums or threaded discussion data service and could, get some people around that.
Mm-hmm.
Then we could build very, very rich UIs on top of it. But we could also use that as the basis for connecting things together to offer a different level of service and composing things at that level. So if you look at some of the work that we've done with the Entity Framework, in particular Astoria, be able to take an EDM model and project it out in a way that's consumable. I think that's one of the ways that this will shift in terms of the developer, being able to pull things together at that level. And there's a continuum between not being able to reason over the data at all and having to specify it to the nth degree. And how today that's more of a, it's either here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we're trying to do with the, the Sitka data model in the middle is to make that more of a smooth continuum,
mm-hmm.
Such that the barrier for entry for developers is very low. I can just walk up to it. I can get the data that I can need. I can massage it, keep it locally. I can put it back either through synchronization or in the context of my program, suck it down, manipulate it, push it back. But I think it's going to be very interesting for developers. One of the things we have in mind for these data services is you can think of queries in some cases as being specifying the set of data that you might want to manipulate, bring it all down. If we had a little link runtime, I could do queries over that locally, modify, and then push parts of it back up to the service afterwards. So I think it'll just become a richer experience for developers.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the final question I'll ask you, you're a technical fellow, so it's going to be a sort of a high-level question, but I know that at the highest levels of the company, the notion of composability, right? You use the composition word. So I want to throw it out there is, let's talk about this model and how that relates to the notion of a truly composable system, where parts get changed, but my app still works, and I don't destroy the universe.
Yep. I actually think that's where things will evolve to in terms of service composition. And it's a rough analogy, but the thing I think of in terms of just what the ecosystem could look like, if you go back and look at the visual basic controls sort of phenomena, right, with people building those, and you know, one person could write one and you know, hundreds or thousands could consume it, but they became part of the environment. They were part of the palette in which I could compose things, if you will. And I think that it'd be interesting, you know, the services world moving towards that. And you can think of services in multiple dimensions. So we'll talk about it in terms of, you know, business processes and such. You could think of fulfillment. You could think of, you know, shopping cart as a service that I could compose from. So imagine just wiring those things up and having everything work in terms of consistency and such. I think that's one interesting perspective. If you think about it from the database, today pretty much what you tell people to do is, okay, here's the server name, here's the database, you give them a connection string, they go on it, and they open up the object explorer, and they look at the tables, look at the columns, they start reverse engineering things in their head. When we think about moving things up a level in terms of abstraction, instead of me thinking about order lines and order headers and, you know, this and that, customers and customer addresses and customer ID, having a higher level model around that, sort of this entity model, you can imagine someone building out palettes of entities. So if I'm a corporate developer, I could have a palette of HR entities that I could just walk up to and get that, and I could have employees and managers and compensation plans and such like that. So immediately start at that level. And I talked about sort of the data platform nouns and verbs and such.
Sure.
You could imagine, once you can compose at a higher level, being able to offer higher level services. So if I go off and build this model, I could then say, if I have a account as an entity, and one of the attributes of the account is maybe a credit card, I could mark that by tagging the model saying that's financially sensitive information. Now, through the rest of the infrastructure, any place where we instantiate that model, we can say that we have a policy in place that says that any place you build that model into a database, we can go check and say that all backups of that database must be encrypted. Or we could say that all connections into that database must be over an encrypted channel. And so some of the stuff that we've done with this version of SQL Server called the Declarative Management Framework starts to build out some of that. So the idea is that once we up-level a lot of these things, now we can go describe platform services. Because the platform in and around the database was sort of defined at the tables and rows level. Now we up-level at one. A lot of the platform services, whether it's synchronization, management, you know, reporting, mining, can all be themselves described at that level, and offers this whole other potential in terms of composing at a higher level rather than the pieces below.
Outstanding. Excellent.
I don't know. Composition is a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And making it easier to compose without making unstable and insecure systems is always a good thing.
Yeah, exactly right. That is the challenge, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, hey, thank you for your time. I know you're very busy.
Yes, thank you.
And always great to talk to technical fellows and see what's going on. But I will ask you one last question.
Sure.
I never end when I say I'm going to end.
Okay, that's fine.
That's how I do this. I was talking to Burton Smith, my last technical fellow on Channel 9. And I'm really curious as to how you guys interact, in the sense that clearly you guys all have to be on the same sort of strategic understanding, and you all innovate in your special areas, but as a group, there's only about 20 of you.
Yeah.
How do you interact? How do you share ideas?
That's a good question. Well, there are several forums in which we get together over the course of the year, and you know, a lot of us have established relationships, and there's no one template, if you will, for a technical fellow. I think I'd say that, well, most of the technical fellows are smarter than the average bear. They've, you know, a lot of experience, but they all look at things differently. And I think, in some sense, the strength of the community and the strength of Microsoft is that there's so much going on here that we can cross-pollinate. So Burton's got a wealth of experience in one domain, and you know, these things come together. And, you know, this is, I bet I get like 3 phone calls a week. And
really?
I've had 3 in the last 4 or 5 months.
That's probably a technical fellow.
No, it's not.
Oh.
I'm gonna close it. So, but it's the cross-pollination of bringing those experiences together. So we do, you know, get together for various events. We try to connect connect with each other and our colleagues. So I think, you know, building that community is very important for the company. And it's a fascinating group of individuals.
Absolutely. Do you guys ever get together with Bill and kind of talk to him about, you know, the highest technical levels? Because he can, I'm sure he could dice with all of you guys,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. No, we do. Collectively, that actually is interesting. You know, the Think Week has sort of been a long-standing thing. A lot of people understand that, that Bill's gone off and looked at thoughts from people around the company. Mm-hmm. In the last year or two, Bill has asked all of the technical fellows to get in, and because the volume of papers and thoughts has grown so large. Mm-hmm. So we're engaged at that level. And that's something that Bill has asked all of us to participate in. So mm-hmm. I just got my assignment. I have 20 papers from folks around the company I need to review on that. But Bill is definitely engaged and spends a fair bit of time with most of us.
Outstanding. So. All right. Well, hey, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Good luck.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great stuff.
Absolutely.